Our next speaker needs no introduction, but I will introduce them. The Value of Repeat Events in Post-Discharge Hospitalized Heart Failure Trials, Stuart Pocock.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about, there's a very varied session here, and I'm now back to chronic heart failure trials, so forget the acute experience you've just been hearing about, and talk about the use of repeat events in these chronic heart failure trials and how we're missing out at the moment. The conventional primary endpoint is time to first heart failure hospitalization or CV death, and the repeat hospitalization for heart failure therefore get ignored. And also any cardiovascular death that occurs after the first heart failure hospitalization is also ignored in analysis. And so I'm going to talk about this. We need agreed methods of how to use all heart failure hospitalizations, which I think is partly why we've backed off so far going this way. And the benefit is we'll gain in statistical power and could do smaller trials if we went the route I'm going to propose. I'm going to focus first. I've got three examples up my sleeve. The first is EMPhASIS trial. This is the standard result. Time to first heart failure hospitalization or cardiovascular death. It has a nice hazard ratio of 0.63, highly significant. That's what you're used to seeing. So now I want to take you into the world of what you're not used to seeing. So we published these approaches to repeat hospitalizations in EMPhASIS. Starting from the numbers of patients in the trial, you can see heart failure hospitalizations were 273 on eplerenone and 429 on placebo. But if you only use the first, you're down to 164 and 253 respectively. The composite primary endpoint also includes cardiovascular deaths that happened without a prior hospitalization for heart failure, and that, therefore, that number is up. So you can see many of these differences, all of this difference is being ignored, and so are many of the cardiovascular deaths. So to put it in one way, the conventional composite primary analysis ignores 43% of cardiovascular deaths because they occurred after a heart failure hospitalization, and it ignores 41% of all hospitalizations for heart failure because these happen to be second, third, or fourth hospitalizations. So there's a sense of could do better. Looking at the distributions of numbers, just to show what it's like, you can see the numbers having one heart failure hospitalization are different between placebo and eplerenone, but so are the numbers having two, three, four, five, etc. And all this information is currently being ignored. One simple graphic for displaying this is to show the cumulative rate of heart failure hospitalizations over time. This looks like a Kaplan-Meier plot, but it's not because it's including repeats. And you can see there's a rapid divergence in the rate of hospitalizations, and it continues to get a little bit wider over time as well. So this is the sort of graphic of all heart failure hospitalizations that I think we should see more commonly in the reporting of chronic heart failure trials. This is an alternative graphic. You can show over time the risk ratio of active drug, in this case eplerenone versus placebo, as data accumulate over time. And you can say the risk ratio of all hospitalizations for heart failure is slightly further away from one. It's down to about a risk ratio of 0.4 in the early time. But as you accumulate more data over two to three years, you can see it goes up a bit nearer to a stable 40%, a risk ratio of 0.6 as you get later. So those two graphics are quite nice to see. And then we've got to get down to making an inference about rates of hospitalization. So what's the best estimate of treatment effect? Well, if you want to naively assume that there's a rate of hospitalization that is essentially the same for all patients in each trial, you can use the simplest method with the Poisson assumption. But it's too naive because it ignores the fact that some patients are hospitalization prone, they're going to have a lot, and there are others who are very not prone who are going to have very few, if many will have zero hospitalizations. So the Poisson assumption gives you a ratio, but its confidence interval is too wide because it's ignored the skewness of the distribution of number of hospitalizations that you saw about three or four slides earlier. So the negative binomial is a method of allowing for that skewness, and it so happens in the EMPhASIS trial that gives you a rate ratio even further away from one, 0.51. You'll see allowing for this skewness makes the confidence interval, the uncertainty, a little bit wider than it is under the naive Poisson assumption. Both of these method ignore deaths, and I'm going to come back to that topic when I get to my third example. So this negative binomial, just if you think you're doing anything new, it's always lovely to give you a reference to the 1920s to show that there's no original thought whatsoever going on here. And this was applied to accident. It was to do with accident proneness for people working in industry. So anyway, let's pretend we're doing something new anyway. So what you're doing with a negative binomial is you're assuming each individual has their own underlying rate of hospitalizations, but those rates will vary between people in a sort of random effect. And you're going to say you need to apply a distribution to how much those rates vary, and a gamma distribution gives you what is helpful to give you the negative binomial distribution. But I don't want to get too technical about this at the moment. Well, from the emphasis trial, you see you've got many different methods of comparing hospitalizations and deaths of eplerenone versus placebo. You can do the original Cox model assumption, and you get that for time to first event. Or you can then do, instead, ignoring many of the other alternatives, you can go to the negative binomial for all heart failure hospitalizations. And then you can also compare the treatment effect you get for time to first hospitalization using a Poisson with the treatment effect on the repeats, that is after the first. And you can show, in fact, in this particular trial, the treatment effect was bigger on preventing second, third, fourth hospitalization than it actually was on preventing the first one, which is quite interesting. Looking at the shift trial of evabradine, my second example, this is the same sort of graph you saw before. It's the cumulative incidence of all heart failure hospitalizations, including repeats. And you can see placebo versus evabradine, you're getting a similar divergence, not quite as big as in the emphasis trial, but you can see that there is a steady divergence over time. And displaying this, I think, is adding to your information that the shift primary endpoint of only using first hospitalizations managed. You can also, in this trial, they've published on the repeat hospitalizations, and they've shown the evabradine effect, the risk ratio for time to first hospitalization, time to second, of course that already means you've had a first, and time to third. And though you can see that the treatment effect of preventing second and third seems just as important, possibly slightly more important, than the effect of time to first. And so I think this is a helpful insight. And of course, the use of repeat hospitalizations also adds into any health economic analyses, because all hospitalizations are roughly equally expensive, whether they were the first or the second. So it has a health economic connection in going this route as well. Now, I want to go to my third example, which is the subset of the overall CHARM trial, which is the CHARM Preserve trial, which is candesartan versus placebo for patients with preserved ejection fraction, i.e. EF above 40. Now, this was an elusive trial when it came to the original primary endpoint, because you can see you were getting a hazard ratio of 0.89 with a p-value of 0.12 for the adjudicated time to first conventional heart failure hospitalization or CV death. Even if you didn't like the adjudication committee and only liked what the investigators said, still you only got a tantalizing p-value of 0.054 for your primary endpoint. So using the conventional primary endpoint, there was insufficient evidence of treatment efficacy in the CHARM Preserve trial. So can we do better if we took a look at the repeat hospitalizations? Again, just to cut corners on the details of this table, the conventional analysis only used 53% of all heart failure hospitalizations, i.e. 47% of hospitalizations were repeats. And it only included 57% of all cardiovascular deaths, because the other 43% happened after a first heart failure hospitalization. The same distribution, for time's sake, I'll skip. The cumulative rate of heart failure hospitalizations for a trial that was inconclusive on its primary endpoint this looks like a tantalizingly interesting cumulative divergence on the rate of hospitalizations over time. Going to the comparison of rates of heart failure hospitalization, you can see the rate per patient year of per 100 patient years of follow-up on candesartan was 9, and on placebo the rate was 12.8 for repeat for including all heart failure hospitalizations. Going straight to the negative binomial analysis, you get a rate ratio of 0.68 and a fairly tight confidence interval and a p-value of 0.001, which is pretty different from the borderline result you were getting for the conventional primary endpoint. This negative binomial allows, as I've said before, for patients having different frailties, different tendencies for hospitalizations and repeats. Now, one problem here is the current, these simpler methods for heart failure hospitalizations ignore cardiovascular deaths. And obviously, patients who are having high hospitalization rates tend to die. And therefore, there's a sort of informative censoring when you cut off at the time of cardiovascular death. You have less follow-up, obviously, as a result. One very simple trick is to modify the method so you include a cardiovascular death as your last event. So you say, I've got events, and my last event, if it wasn't linked to a very recent hospitalization, I'll count as an extra event. So that's a simple trick for including cardiovascular deaths in the analysis. And if you do that, the rate ratio is attenuated from 0.68 to 0.75, but remains a highly significant difference. Looking at power calculations based on charm preserved, I'll cut corners again here because of time, but you can see a trial of 2,500 patients using either adjudicated or the unadjudicated event, first composite events, was lacking power. Statistical power to detect treatment difference was at best around 0.5, whereas you were using repeat events, you've got the, with a trial of 2,500 patients, you've got the power up to about 0.8. So it looks like somewhere between trials could be reduced in size by somewhere between a third and a half if you use repeat events rather than just using the first, which is attractive for future trial planning. Now, I'm going to finish with some nasty stats, and I'll go lightly on you. There is another alternative method, which is an extension of Cox proportional hazards models, which does time to first hospitalization, and then it models time to second and time to third, and assumes that the effect is the same of treatment on all repeat hospitalizations. You'll be pleased to know I find this paper completely unreadable, but it's actually become a widely accepted method in this repeat events field. It has some problems because it assumes that the events, repeat events, are independent of one another, so it's falling into the same trap as the Poisson method. But some clever tricks have attempted to adjust for that problem. But you're pleased to know that the rate ratio you get out of Anderson-Gill agrees rather closely with the simpler negative binomial method, and the conclusion is clearly going to be the same. So that's one method. A last nasty trick is to make it more complicated still, and to say you have a rate process of repeat hospitalizations going along, and parallel to it, you have a risk of dying. And we will assume that patients have a frailty, and that frailty applies equally well to the hospitalization rate and the risk of dying. And so you have what's called joint modeling of a hospitalization process and mortality process. And you can integrate out the two to come up with a conclusion about the hospitalizations, having adjusted for the mortality process. But again, you're into pretty heavy stats reading. And I think this is going to be a problem for trials with a regulatory intent, is to make this method robust enough and straightforward enough to clinicians and non-statistical regulators to understand what's actually being done. So in conclusion, talking about planning of future heart failure trials, use of all heart failure hospitalizations as a primary endpoint, I think, has great potential. Should we go that route? You'll have a gain in statistical power, so you can reduce trial size and potentially length of follow-up if you want to go that route. There's going to be a dialogue. There is already an ongoing dialogue with the FDA and EMA advisors on how to go with this this methodology. And we need to agree an analysis strategy that is comprehensible when you present the results and also robust to satisfy the complexity of how to take account of cardiovascular deaths. After long session now, if you're asleep, I have every sympathy, but thanks for listening for those who did. Thank you.
Comments? Apparently Adrian didn't fall asleep. Comments?
We have time for a couple quick questions. Mark?
Adrian? Sorry. I didn't think it was provocative, but it was very convincing. So, but there's one thing, and maybe I didn't understand it well, but did you take into account the fact that if you, for example, have a 100-patient trial and you have a drug that reduces 10 hospitalizations, it can be either 10 hospitalizations in the same patient, but it can also be 10 first hospitalizations in 10 different patients. And in your calculation, it would have been a similar effect, although I would personally prefer to have better 10 different patients than 10 hospitalizations in one patient. But
no, it would. The proper methods, the Poisson method, would not take that into account. It just gives you a crude rate, and that's exactly why it's not very good. You need to say 10 different patients having different individual hospitalizations does indeed contain more than 10 in one patient. And the negative binomial methodology does take that into account, as do the other methods. So that's right. Given more time, I could explain how. But yes, you wouldn't want to make that naive assumption that those two are the same. That's right.
A wrist slapped. Charm preserved is a good example. We knew we were reducing all heart failure hospitalizations pretty reliably. We knew that. But we also knew we stepped outside of the guidelines that people have imposed. So how does one develop this dialogue to say, let's not misinformation and let's look at things in this way in the future?
Well, I think there are brave sponsors dipping into this realm. I'm aware of three right now, one in the drug world and two in the device world, that are realizing that the benefits of using repeats. And I look to Rob for a comment, but in principle, I think there's a receptiveness. But Rob, would you like to take this up? Rob Hemmings.
Well, this is precisely what I'll talk about if I've got a couple of minutes to give a discussion later, but I'll pick up on exactly this point. Yeah.
Okay, maybe John, a final comment, and then we will move on for the two last presentations.
It was just to put another perspective on this, that when you look at the total amount of time that patients actually spend in hospital on their journey during the clinical trial, it is so diminishingly small that you wonder why we put so much emphasis on these events. I realize that there is a cost consequence of them, but in terms of the total patient experience, sometimes it's bloody awful, of course, but in terms of the total patient experience, it applies to so few days in that patient's life. You wonder why we put so much emphasis on it, and why don't we have a proper endpoint like QALY?
Well, it's a marker of how you're not doing too well.
It's a surrogate. It's a surrogate measure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. We are going to move...